speaking through a trash can.
No, I'm being normal.
Well, it's an icy nice world.
That's what... Okay, so the name Nicey Nice World?
Yeah.
The phrase... Okay, so the phrase is usually spoken in the negative. It's not a nicey nice world out there.
While he's cocking and a shotgun or something.
I did look it up, though, and they said it was usually in reference to shoes. The shoes that you would wear on Sunday were your nicey nice shoes.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay, yeah, little vest.
Right?
Little vest, maybe a little bow tie, even.
Well, your shoes, though. The shoes, specifically. So it was the patent leathers.
Shoe me. Shoe me. Do me a favor. No.
Just now.
You know, it's I have so many questions for you, but I feel like we need to go, like, further back. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I do, too. I would recommend going back all the way to the beginning. My life is an open book.
I would go all the way back to the beginning. Now, you know, you talk about traditional upbringing. You had definitely had a traditional upbringing, but it wasn't a traditional upbringing.
I like the way you put that.
Right? I mean, no, rich
yeah,
in
sure.
tradition.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, okay, so take me back. Utah, young man in Utah.
No, I was I was in Northern California, Sacramento.
Sacramento, okay.
Now, my father, indeed, was born in Utah, but Ogden, to be specific. They came out during the Depression, though, and they... lived under a tree for several months until they got rained out.
What do you mean, lived under a tree?
There's an old oak tree in near Roseville, Citrus Heights, California, actually. And they put a piece of tin over, you know, some of the branches. They put the, you know, the cooking area under that. Everybody else slept under the stars.
So, I mean, it was a full-on, you know, camping out, but not for fun. We're just doing this.
This is where we live, yeah. While my grandfather built a house as a carpenter.
So, okay, so we have a house going in. We've got, you know, a piece of tin turning a tree into our house, into a makeshift.
Yeah, right.
Like, not even a lean-to, really, if you want to get down to it. Kind of a...
Not even a lean-to. It's just a house with a little extra rain offage.
So what precipitated the move to Northern California? How do you end up in that situation?
Let's see. Well, it was...
Gold in them there hills? Or
it was the economy, actually. My grandfather moved from Ogden to find work in California. It wasn't quite the Depression yet. But not everybody was doing, you know, the Roaring Twenties.
And he was Mormon.
He was Mormon.
Right. Stormin' Mormon.
He's Stormin' Mormon. Why did I never think of that before?
I know, really, right? It seems so obvious. the Stormin' Mormon. What if BYU changed their name to the Stormin' Mormons? Now that's something.
I mean, it beats the Jazz.
The Jazz, because when I'm in Salt Lake, you know, if there's one thing I can't escape when I'm in Salt Lake, Utah, is that yeah. delicious jazz music coming from every. No, but okay, so you know, financial situation precipitates the move. There you are.
Right.
You've made it to, I guess, the command seat of California, right? Sacramento.
This is way before me. I came along, you know, after the war.
Now
I'm a baby.
Did your dad fight in the war?
in a way.
Okay. Well, we don't need to go into that too much. I mean, it was a weird time. Conscientious objector or?
Oh, no. I don't think that would have worked anyway. Well, it wouldn't have. Because I knew a Mormon guy.
They hadn't even thought of that yet.
Did try conscientious objector to get out of going to Vietnam. And they said, you're a Mormon. You're not a conscientious objector, which is true. The Mormons basically were behind the war. As a matter of fact, the Mormon Church
don't say behind the war. Like it was the Mormons that caused the war. Well, you know what I mean?
Mormons as a group are very conservative. So, that era's Republican which were pretty warlike. So they were on board with the war. And they limited only two members of the church could go on missions, because usually the Mormons have their young men go on missions to preach the gospel to the heathen.
That's the point of the mission, right? To take the book out into the street and
how much do you know about Jesus Christ? Would you like to know more?
I mean,
but I didn't want to do that. So I was kind of happy that only two now, and because everybody else had to be available for the draft.
What year was this? Was sort of been 66.
I graduated from high school in 66.
66. Okay. Are you still in Sacramento at this time?
I'm in Sacramento. Yeah.
Now, did you get sucked into the war effort as well? I mean,
In 1966, when I graduated, my choices were this. Join the Army, which you could volunteer for the draft, and you don't have to go in for 2 years. But otherwise, it was going to be 4 years. So my choices were this.
You're 16?
I'm 18.
18, okay, 18. It's time to make a decision.
Yeah. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines.
So the thing was, roll the dice and maybe have to go for 4 years minimum.
Or... Well, right. I'm one of my good friends. He opted for going, volunteering for the draft. And I said, gee, you're going to go straight to Vietnam.
Right.
So I opted for the Navy.
Because you figured, how are they going to get that big ship up into the jungle?
You were thinking? Right, exactly. Exactly. I just didn't think there was a lot of Navy there. And so he went in. He went to Turkey. A radio station way the hell out in the middle of nowhere, a radar station, and then he went to Ramstein, Germany, and then he was out.
He did his 2 years and he was out.
Uh-huh. I went straight to Vietnam.
After you have volunteered for the Navy, you're saying?
Yeah.
They said, hey, we figured it out. We're just going to hollow out part of the mountain and make a little bay there and we get the ship right in there.
Well, as it turns out, I wasn't in the mud and the blood, though. I was on a spy ship.
Oh, you were in the rear with the gear.
You can say that.
When you were drafted, so you volunteered Navy, and they said, okay, pack up your stuff. You're going to Vietnam. Now,
For me, it was either Air Force, Navy. That was it.
Was that going to be a 2-year commitment or?
No, that was a 4-year commitment.
Damn.
Because I didn't volunteer for the draft. I joined the Navy.
I see. Well, that's not exactly Ramstein, Germany. It's not exactly
right.
It's not exactly hosing bird shit off of statues in Lexington, Kentucky or something.
Well, I didn't go straight to Vietnam. I went to 3 months of school. school to become to work in supply.
So you were with you were with a bunch of other young men that were also kind of learning that.
Yeah.
How was the mood there? Like, did everybody realize 4 years, geez, we're in this kind of thing? I mean, what was the mood of the day-to-day soldier in boot camp there?
All right, so it kind of separated out into some gung-ho, more or less conservative, but warrior types. And that was really kind of a minority. Then there was a bunch of us who were just trying to avoid the draft, trying to just do the best we could with this situation. And so, you know, we're 18, we're 19. And we're just like, I think most people didn't understand the war at all.
Anything about it, like why we were there, what the objectives were?
I didn't. You know, at 18, I'd kind of bought into the propaganda, the domino theory. We can't let these little countries turn communist or, you know, the world is lost.
Wow. I mean, they just said it then, huh? I mean, it's Cold War.
It wasn't long before I figured out, wait a minute, in Vietnam, we're the British.
Oh, right. Right.
And
when do you realize that as a young soldier? When does that switch flip?
Well, it wasn't from anything I saw. It was just this growing realization that, wait a minute, why are we fighting North Vietnam? And so I, you know, then you look around a little bit, you know, you look stuff up and you learn a little bit more about the Gulf of Tonkin situation where, no, they didn't shoot the torpedoes and we weren't attacked and it was a lie. And you begin to learn things like this.
But that information comes from the general public. Is this something you're discussing amongst yourselves in barracks when it's downtime, or is it something
that
comes up, you go outside the base, right? Though you interact with the general public.
Yeah, sure. And
I mean, how aware of the anti-war movement were you, as a young man?
Really not until I came back from Vietnam.
Okay. You didn't realize that there was this undercurrent of.
Okay, so I go to Vietnam in 67. I come back in 68. Those were key years. 67 is the summer of love, and 68, the anti-war movement is really at that point going pretty strong. Nixon's on his way into the White House. And
now, when you came back, were you out? Like you were, that's it?
No. I had 2.5 more years to do.
But you came back to the stateside.
Came back to the States. And because I'd done a tour of duty in Vietnam, I got preferred duty, as they called it. I still wasn't eligible to rotate to shore duty, as they called it, a land-based assignment. But I did get on a ship that never leaves port. It was a submarine tender in San Diego.
Wow. So you're thinking,
almost
yeah, I just gotta get through this.
Mm-hmm. Very much. Very much.
So there you are. You're parked in the ship. Now, you're aware that there's this huge anti-war movement happening, San Diego.
Yeah. And it's relatively strong in San Diego.
Well, sure, yeah, there's a lot of military there, so kind of get both in that situation, right?
Yeah, I eventually rented an apartment with some guys on the shore, and one of those guys went full conscientious objector.
Wow, that's it. And burned his issued bra. I don't know. I'm channeling my dad. Yeah.
Well, so there was this. He was the ship's librarian.
Okay.
And you know, he was a young seaman, but he was the ship's librarian. And one day his division officer comes in and he finds this anti-war newspaper called Duck Power.
Okay.
In there, and he comes and throws it on the guy's desk. Is what is this? I don't know. Somebody brought it in. So if I find one of these in here again, you're on report. And so he wondered what had gotten his officer in panties in a bunch.
Yeah, what's that? Let me throw that away for you.
He didn't know anything about. So he the officer left him the newspaper. So he looked the people up. He went and found them in the community and joined the staff. And the next issue, he brought 50 of them into the library and put them out there for people to
grab. Oh, boy. See, that's a problem. that's a small that's a small problem turning into a bigger problem. So,
what happens at that point?
Did they kick him out? Or
Captain's mask, threw him in the brig, 30 days, and then dishonorable discharge.
Damn. I mean, come on.
Right? Oh, they really got upset over this Duck Power. So I did the same thing.
You went and met the people and...
I went and met the people. There was a group... Actually, it was... there was an underground newspaper called San Diego Street Journal at the time. And that was who... Well, a sailor had come to them and said, hey, you know, we want to do a magazine and it's this, and it's going to be anti-war, and it's, you know, GIs against the war. And so they said, yeah, you can use our presses. So these sailors came in and did the Duck Power on the Street Journal presses. So I met with those people. And it was some pretty hairy days. It was the days of the SAO, it was called. They were off-duty, generally off-duty San Diego police officers who were doing ultra-right wing stuff. They bombed the Guild Theater because it was porno.
Jesus, what the fuck?
They weren't messing around.
This is around 1968.
Yeah.
So how many more years commitment did you have at that moment with the military?
My release would have been my sweet release would have been January 71.
You said young. You said young seaman earlier, so I guess sweet release. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
The glorious moment of release was.
Sweet release was November 70 is when I got out.
So there was a little bit of. It was kind of a rough year there, huh?
Oh, I'm telling you.
Wow. I mean, a little clandestine, a little, you know, wanting to be...
People were pretty polarized. I think people took it less seriously than today's polarization, though.
That's hard to imagine, but yeah. I mean...
I know. Well, we just wanted to listen to music. It's the 60s.
You know? Well, you were hearing stories of what happened the summer before, and you're like, hey, now hold on here. You know,
right?
What's this summer of love deal here?
Well, right, and I kind of got in trouble too, but it was a marijuana arrest, and so I barely got out with, my honorable discharge. I did get out. So that's why I've got, veterans health care now. And so it worked out all right for me.
I mean, you're a veteran. Okay. So there you are. 1969, you're out.
I'm out. Well, 70, I'm out.
1970, you're out.
Yeah. And I started working in a movie theater, the Guild Theater.
The same one that would be blown up, that was blown up?
Well, a few people owned it, but a different theater.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I said the Guild. I meant the Academy Theater. The Guild was, yeah, that's the one they blew up. But I was going to the midnight movies while I was still in the Navy. And that was a scene. Unbelievable.
Midnight movies.
Yeah. They did show midnight movies. It was a thing. A guy that had put it together up in L.A. So he put every week he'd do this new 90-minute collection of weird things, cartoons, odd movies from the past, counterculture stuff.
Like a montage.
Kind of. Oh, there'd be a whole cartoon. And then they would go to, another piece of something. But it was all counterculture, called the Midnight Movies. So,
sounds so like a
I
scene.
Was going to that. Yeah. It's hard to describe what was going on in this movie theater every Friday night at midnight. It was after the buses stopped running. I bought a motorcycle just so I could go to this thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And it included the lack of talent contest. If you got up and did something on stage for the lack of talent contest, you could come back to the Underground Movies next week for free.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there was a healthy little group of performers.
Well, right. About a third of the audience would get up and do something. Probably about a third of it was guys who would get up, drop their pants, and brown eye the audience.
Fair enough.
For real.
All right.
Fair enough.
Full moon.
They'd get their pants to come back next week, and that's all they had to do. And
that,
so they
that's
did.
All, huh?
Well.
Get up on stage.
It's got to be kind of a thing.
Get up on stage. Show your asshole. You get to come here for free next week.
Exactly.
What about in the crowd?
But, the crowd loved it, But there was also people get up, sing a song, or there was comedians that would get up and do a bit. Jose Sinatra came out of that.
Okay.
He would get up and do hits of the 70s with obscene lyrics.
Wow.
He called it Beatlelingus music, and out of that he became Jose Sinatra. That was a huge thing. But yeah, it was freeform. You wouldn't even call it open mic. There was no mic, but it was the most freeform thing I've ever seen in my life to this day.
Wow.
But so it was great. So I was going to that, and I met the people that ran the theater and became friends with them. And when I got out of the Navy, I got a job at the movie theater.
Oh, okay.
And eventually became a projectionist. I first started out carrying tickets at the door and then the concession stand. And then finally the projection booth. I'm a projectionist, So I did that for several years. Wound up becoming a manager at a movie theater. Wound up at the Guild for a little while, and then they bought a theater in PB, the Fine Arts, and I went down to manage that for 3 years.
Wow. This is like a regular movie theater.
Yeah. We were doing first-run foreign films.
What an odd time, huh?
Odd time, yeah. But we were, it was Fellini and Truffaut and all of that.
So okay. When do you start getting the itch to perform music? I mean, when did
right? So I didn't really have an itch to perform music. But I had I had loved music ever since I was in high school. Big Rolling Stones fan. The whole English thing, that was my English invasion music was my thing. Stones, Kinks, Animals, all of that. And I had, by that point, I had a bunch of records. And so that continued. I'm continuing to buy records.
You're noticing, geez, I've got a huge set of records here.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, at that point it's Velvet Underground but I'm also getting an ear for kind of, you know, weirdness. And
this is 1970. This is the beginning of the punk scene in San Diego. This is the very, very,
very, well, there was no punk yet.
Right. I mean, this is like the tabula rasa, if you will.
See, about 74, punk's starting to happen in New York, but nowhere else. Hmm. We knew of no such thing. Now, I was into the Velvet Underground and Stooges by that time. But, and so it was happening. It was growing. You know, it was getting there. And so I was into the weirdness. I think a group like Kraftwerk, Can, I guess would be the way to pronounce that, German group, edgy stuff. And then Eno, and, you know, I'm Bowie, Roxy Music, all of that stuff is really interesting to me. And then Eno leaves Roxy Music, and he puts out a few records, and I'm into that. Then he puts out a record in 75, Discreet Music. And it's the first ambient
record. Is this before Songs for Airports?
Yeah, this is before Songs for Airports.
Okay.
So Songs for Airports, I think, was the next ambient record that he did.
Okay.
He invents the term ambient records in the liner notes on Discreet Music.
So what about hearing that for the first time? I mean, it sounded like nothing else.
And I was turned on like nobody's business.
Like, okay, all right.
The same year, though, Lou Reed put out Metal Machine Music.
Okay.
And that caught me right at home. I bought that thing.
Well, I mean, I'll quote Lou Reed on that album. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be.
Well, I loved it. I brought it home. It's two record set. I listened to all four sides twice. It took me most of the afternoon. I woke up a changed person.
Like, I don't even think Lou Reed listened to it twice. Do you know what I mean? Like right. I have never met anyone that listened to the whole thing at all.
Well, there's a certain amount of people out there that think it was Lou Reed's fuck you to Warner Brothers to get out of the contract. He had to deliver an album, so he delivered that. And maybe that's true. I don't know, but I discovered possibilities in music that I didn't know existed before.
Yeah.
So I started doing music.
You listen to something that shouldn't be. I mean,
I wouldn't trust that so much. But at any rate, I think you liked it myself.
Last Dance with Mary Jane also supposedly is a fuck you from Tom Petty to the record company.
Well, that's appropriate.
Yeah, like you owe us one more single. Okay, here you go. Here's a top 10 hit. There you go.
Yeah,
this is what I could do for you easily.
That would be a good explanation for Tom Petty. Not a big fan, although I don't think he's terrible. I don't think he's terrible, but just not a huge fan of that.
Well, I don't want to get on too off track here, but the new trailer for the next Grand Theft Auto game that's coming out next year or in 2025 actually. It's coming out in 2025. Tom Petty, Love is a Long Road, is the song they use for the trailer.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
You what?
Did you see that trailer?
I didn't see the trailer.
It's unbelievable. Tom Petty kills it.
Okay.
Anyway.
Right?
So there you are.
So there I am. I'm discovering possibilities of music that Which I'd already loved music, but I wasn't a musician. I wasn't a musician. Didn't play anything. So my roommate had a piano in the apartment, and in the house, actually. And so he'd be at work, and I would tinkle with it. And tinkle isn't exactly the right word, because I basically would pound on it with my fists.
I see. You were learning the instrument.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd flail for a few minutes, and then a pattern would begin to emerge that was pleasing to me.
I see. Not so much to the neighbors, but to you, definitely.
Well, right. The landlord lived next door, and one day they came to the, I hear a knock at the door. I'm pounding away. I've been going for hours, and which I really could do, you know. And so it's the landlord and his wife, and, you know, they have been making this noise for, you know, a while now. You know, can't you cut it out? And but his wife is standing behind him. She's in tears. She's going, "That's not music. That's not music." Which suggested to me, I didn't know it was music or not. I wasn't really the point, you know, but I thought, you know, that suggested to me that maybe it is music.
Maybe it is music. She seems to have a visceral reaction to it. She seemed to be really unhappy about it.
Yeah, and I was, okay, I'll stop, you know. But, you know, I didn't stop forever. I kept at it, and I started picking up different tape recorder to tape, you know, the noises that I was making.
Sure.
I got a synthesizer, found a used synthesizer, okay. Moog Sonic 6. I got an organ, and I just started making noise and recording it. It was pretty noisy.
Okay.
But I would take some of these tapes and play them at the Midnight Movies when I was working there. This was at the Guild before I went down to the Fine Arts. And so I was playing these noises that I'd made, but the movie was Eraserhead that we were showing. You know, yeah. It wasn't like the old Midnight Movies that had gotten shut down.
So it didn't really stand out that it wasn't the soundtrack of the film.
Yeah. Well, right. No. Some people that I eventually met in the punk movement here in San Diego, I met there, and like one of them was a guy named Steve Hitchcock, who called himself Steve Shitcock.
Oh, okay.
And
it's clever.
Wound up later in a fairly noisy punk band called the Young Americans, and but he came running out into the lobby. Who is doing this music? You know, friends. And but at the same time, right about this time, I guess somebody's calling. That's what's happening with this phone. At any rate,
Steve Shitcock, right.
And so I was also, there was a record store near my house called Scratching the Surface, run by a guy named Frank Gutch. And so I'm getting all this, you know, new, weird, punk stuff. You know, it's 78 now.
Okay.
And,
I'm with you.
So I'm getting all this punk stuff there. I bought my first Sex Pistols, first Pair Ubu, got some power pop stuff, Reckless Eric, and this isn't my introduction to punk rock, really, except for the stuff I was seeing on the TV, and because it was kind of big news, you know, Sex Pistols, you know, and I thought that was an outrageous name.
No, are you seeing punk bands pop up now in San Diego at this time now? Is this the beginning of the...
Not quite. I was having to go to Los Angeles to see live punk bands.
So what live music was being performed in San Diego proper? Like what bands were performing live there? Just mainstream bands?
Well, bar bands. Okay. They would do four sets of you know, Foreigner and ELO and Boston covers.
That sounds great, actually, but okay.
It was, well, you know, I wasn't the music I was looking for at the time, but I would go.
If I showed up at a bar and they're, hey, we're blah, 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 we do ELO. It's like, okay, all right. So, yeah, let's listen to some ELO covers, you know. I don't got a problem with that.
Well, it would play better now, I think, than it did then. But that's what you found in San Diego. So I was going to the Mask. I went to San Francisco to the Mabuhay Gardens, and it was going on there. And so I went to those places in 77. It's not until 78 that actually it was Frank Gutch, a couple of guys from the Zeros, myself, Gary Heffern from eventually from the Penetrators. And we started having these meetings at Scratching the Surface about how to start, you know, get some punk shows going in San Diego.
Wow.
And I had found a building. I went to the Mask and I got lists of all the bands and their phone numbers that were playing at the Mask at the time. They were very helpful. They wanted to help San Diego get some, you know, live punk rock. But eventually it came together at the Adam Avenue Theater, which had the first punk show. It was the Dills, the Zeros, and the Hitmakers.
Wow.
And all San Diego bands. And so
was, what was that like? I mean, in terms of, I mean, did the people present realize that they were at some historical moment, or was it just,
yeah, hey, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Like, this is the beginning.
This is the next big thing. And they knew it, even though it wasn't a big thing. And,
I mean, there weren't even really places to play really at that moment.
No, there were not, you know, and that's why, you know, this meeting that, you know, Frank Gutch kind of chaired was so key in getting it going. And so then the Dills immediately moved to San Francisco.
Okay.
So the next show at the Adams Avenue Theater is the Penetrators, the Zeros, and the Hitmakers.
So in between the first show, coming up with the idea for the thing, then it was like, all right, let's be a band also and do
yeah,
this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Gary was doing a band, Heffern was doing a band called Monotone and the Nucleoids.
Okay, I like it.
But he had hooked up with Chris Sullivan, the bass player, and Scott Harrington was the guitarist. And they got Joel Kamak to be the drummer, and they formed the Penetrators at that time. And so just for that show, so they could play.
And you performed with them, or?
No. I'm not in the band for several more months.
Okay.
But that was the last punk show at the Adams Avenue Theater for a while. They talked a gay teen disco called Abbey Road into turning over the club every other Monday night to be punk shows.
Okay. Monday night and punk shows. All right.
Oh yeah. 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 I was there every week that, you know, they had one, and every other week actually. And I went to every one of them. And, so that's where the scene coalesced really right there.
Wow.
And I, you know, by the time the Skeleton Club opens up the following year, there is a bunch of San Diego punk rock bands and maybe 150 people total that would populate the shows.
Right. Same 150. Right.
Of which any week would be about 50 people would show up.
Sure.
Okay. Out of that 150.
But it was from the same group, basically. Like, those were the fans.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It was pretty incestuous, yeah. But, out of that came San Diego punk rock, and it was a lively scene.
When did you join the Penetrators?
So the Penetrators were recording a single, Sensitive Boy. I was in a band called The Dots, and we did some of the shows that, I mean, now shows are happening at people's houses.
Sure. You know, okay. Backyard shows.
Rock show. Yeah. And so I did a couple of those, and I had the synthesizer, I had the noise making stuff that I was doing. Gary wanted some weirdness in his song, so he invited me to come in with my synthesizer and, you know, do something for the new single that they were recording, Sensitive Boy. So I did that, and they liked it. They wanted me to do it in performance with them. I learned four songs of theirs and joined the band in time for them to open up with David Johansen. Wow. At the back door. So first time I ever played on stage anyway, I'm opening up for a national act at a college, venue.
Wow.
And, it was kind of amazing. I had friends in one of these bar bands, and they were knocking themselves out, you know, trying to do metal, basically hair metal. And they had opened up to New York Dolls, David Johansen's first group, and knocking themselves out. They didn't really have that many original songs, but they really wanted to get a record deal. So then they hear that I'm opening for David Johansen. And they're going, what? I didn't even know Carl was a musician, you know? And I really wasn't. So it was interesting. It was kind of the way punk hit a lot of people. But it was an amazing era.
So, but then did they come to you and say, hey, look, you know, you should just be in this band?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly it.
And you were like, okay. So,
yeah. Yeah. So, but within a couple of months, we're playing LA, we're playing San Francisco, we're playing Phoenix, and pretty heady stuff. It looked like we were, oh, wow, we're going to get signed and we're going to get, you know.
Sure.
We're going to be rock stars. And.
Well, I mean, you were a touring musician, so.
Yeah, exactly. And we did. We did do that. And we were getting a lot of press, too, because the press was really interested in punk rock. So you can find news reports on YouTube.
It's such a strange moment when you think about it because, you know, around 1980, right, the entire country is sort of mainstream music is sort of turning to this hair metal, ballads, you know, it's not really, you know, you don't hear a lot of punk music really on the radio.
Oh, that's correct. That's correct. And we really did think that we were the future of music. And I mean, that was absolutely true. Directions in music came from punk, and it looked like hair metal was kind of dying out. So we thought we were the next wave. And there was even a time when we shared a bill with one of the hair metal bands called Mickey Rat.
Oh, okay.
And we kind of made fun of them, and they kind of made fun of us. And then they got the recording contract.
Oh, yeah. They got huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And changed their name to Rat to do it, but didn't, you know. But... But they did. They got pretty big, round, and you know.
How much did the end of the Vietnam War kind of facilitate this in the sense of people were kind of getting together in a counterculture way to discuss the war and, you know, now what do we do kind of thing? I'm just wondering how big of an effect did that have in terms of the freedom of the music? Doing a different style of music, trying to make it happen.
Yeah. Most of the people that were getting into punk rock were too young to have taken part in Vietnam or, you know, the war.
So there, but there was that, there was that feeling, there, that feeling was there though. Like, where's our protest is what I'm getting at, kind of. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they
yeah.
showed up. They showed up too late to the party. The party was ending, and they were like, "Wait, hold on, we've got anger."
Reagan comes in 80, and so, and most of the punks are radical leftists. Are radical anyway. I mean, there was a split off to skinheads too. That happened.
Oh yeah, that's true. There's that whole part of punk.
So there was a Nazi element in amongst the punks. But that kind of came later. At first, it was just people. Well, I'm reminded by the line in The Wild Ones, that motorcycle movie with the Marlon Brando, and so they're all, you know, the girl in the coffee shop is asking, well, you know, what are you rebelling against? And he goes, what do you got?
What do you got? I mean, you know.
And that's kind of the way it was with punk rock, you know. Well, Reagan was easy to be against, hard against, you know. And the war, well, there was no war, but Reagan wanted a war, and he did Grenada.
He wanted the war.
Yeah. You know, he attacks, it was, Panama, he attacked Panama.
Right.
And arrested Noriega and all of that, which Noriega was our guy anyway. So.
Yeah, I guess take him off the payroll, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. But, so, yeah, that was heady times, to be sure. And from 79 to 84, we were regularly playing in kind of the Western United States.
And you were gaining a bit of international acclaim as well.
Yeah. We were making records. We sold a lot of records in France, apparently, which was odd. Outside of California, that was our next biggest, you know, place to sell records was France. But we'd gotten a deal with Virgin Records France, so that's kind of
okay.
How that had happened. And it was a distribution deal. It wasn't a, you know, a make records and put the band on the road deal.
So was there any talk of going to Europe, touring around?
Sure. We had all of the major labels coming to our shows in their, you know, in their silk jackets and
right.
with the logo of the record company on the back. And
classy.
yeah. Capitol, Atlantic, A&M. They were all there. We recorded some stuff at A&M too, a video, which I'd like to find that. I don't know if that exists anywhere. I think Herb Alpert showed up at one of the recordings, if I remember right.
So, okay. All right. So that's an interesting moment there. I mean, you guys are a few years into it. You've had some success, yeah. Not exactly the success that you wanted or had hoped for, but certainly success.
Oh, I didn't hope for anything at all.
Well, in terms of being signed by a major label and, you know, doing something here in the States.
I mean, it looked like it was going to happen. That was never my agenda.
Well, I think that mechanism, like during grunge music, of course, you see all the labels descend upon Seattle and do mass signings, right?
They were
signing bands that had never performed. Go ahead.
The model for that was what had happened with punk rock. Because with punk rock, at first it was just these small independent labels like Bump and Danger House and, you know, that would put out a 7-inch single and hope to make their money back. And
right.
So, which though eventually, like, it happened in New York first. Sire Records and Elektra Records we're realizing that these little labels in New York, like Orc Records, were onto something that looked like it had legs. And so let's lock up some of these people, like Talking Heads,
sure,
and the Cramps, and let's you know, let's get in this thing before it gets big, which it did.
Right.
So they were kind of ready for it when the grunge thing happened.
Oh yeah. Well, that was weaponized, you know. That was mm-hmm. a weaponized movement, the grunge movement. I mean, there was there were bands being signed to major deals that had never performed live before.
Right. And I have to say, I there was something that was a little, I never really got into it. I loved Nirvana.
Right.
Right off the bat. Smells Like Teen Spirit is one of, you know, the very best rock songs ever written.
And when you talk about Smells Like Teen Spirit, you're talking about, let's say, halfway to 60% through the movement at that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, of course, grunge starts off, I mean, if you want to go right to the very beginning, you got to go to a band like Green River, which was a metal band. I mean, you know,
exactly.
It started off as metal.
It was pretty metally. Yeah. Well, you know, the Alice in Chains and Sound.
Well, I mean, you know, Green River dissolves. Two of the members become part of Pearl Jam. Another one goes over and becomes part of Mother Love Bone. So it's
right,
you can trace everything back to kind of just a couple of bands, you know, at the beginning. But then this regional sound started to come out of it, which was, you know, this feedback, this three chords and the truth kind of perspective.
So that's, and by that point, Penetrators are pretty much done.
But I think with punk music, would you say with punk music that there's less, you know, because with grunge, there were bands that were, okay, let's get in on this. Let's give ourselves a grunge sound. Let's redefine ourselves. There was a lot of bands that went through that. Like, let's move back. Bands that had moved out of Seattle and moved to LA were now moving back to Seattle to try to get in on that. Do you think that punk was limited in the sense that, I mean, my feeling with punk music is, it's, if you're a punk artist, it's less likely you're going to try to copy another punk artist. That's my feeling. Like, you don't want to sound like somebody. Am I off on that, or was it, you know, did you guys sit around and going, okay, how do we make ourselves sound like this?
The DIY spirit was look for something new, for sure.
Right.
However, how many of the LA bands wanted to sound like Johnny Rotten?
Sure. Well, then we get Guns N' Roses. Hey, we get Guns N' Roses from that, right?
Sure. Well, so I mean, that's actually the continuation of metal.
Well, metal, I find a lot of punk in there too, in early Guns N' Roses. Like it's,
yeah, sure, absolutely.
I think they were kind of deciding, you know.
Definitely crossover in some of those groups, for sure.
Right. There was just more money in hair metal.
Sure. But punk energy infused everything.
Sure.
But, so...
So what happens in 1984? I mean, you guys are... You know, I mean, had you sensed that you had hit a ceiling there, or...
I'm moving back to my noise music roots.
Okay.
So I'm not really following this, you know, the trail to grunge at all.
But I'm saying, as the Penetrators,
we're done. 84, we're done.
So I mean, what was that moment like? I mean, in terms of, you guys had just had enough. It wasn't enough for some members. How did that decision take place?
Well, our iconic drummer Dan McLean, who became Country Dick Montana, he wanted to do a country western band, so he formed one called the Snuggle Bunnies.
Okay.
And drummed for us and for them for a little while, but
I see.
We were playing teen clubs by 1984.
Right.
83, really. And that was about it. So we didn't, you know, we hadn't gotten any kind of major label. Gary was having trouble with heroin, and so it, the impetus for the band just kind of
dissolved. It seems like you had reached a level of success beyond let's form a band. I mean, you know,
well, for 4 years we were the top draw San Diego band.
That's what I'm saying. You hear people refer to the Penetrators as the godfathers of the San Diego punk scene. I don't think that's very inaccurate, right? I mean, that's
not completely inaccurate. I mean, Gary and I were in on those first meetings to attempt to bring San Diego punk rock.
Like, why do we got to drive to LA and Frisco? We should have places to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which I love doing that. The mask was, you know, it was a very similar kind of thing. I mean, that's why punk was so regional, because it wasn't national yet. You could only be regional, you know? And
it's a different perspective though than somebody now, a band now, for example, that comes up with it and okay, we got to promote our band. You're talking about, it's a little different in the sense that you're talking about forming the band. Now we got to figure out a place to perform. You know, it's like, these are all groundbreaking ideas, you know, that all kind of have to line up for it to work.
And there were a few people that were just really avid about this new thing that felt really important to us.
Right. I mean, it's almost, in a way, it's kind of strange. It's like, would it have been better if it was more the way it was done in the 90s, like in terms of a bunch, you know, huge conglomerates coming in, sucking up bands, signing bands, you know, that kind of feeding frenzy. Like, you know, the San Diego punk scene missed out on that, but in a way it kind of preserved the moment.
I mean, MCA came in and tried to sign a couple of bands kind of late, sort of in the early 80s. They really didn't do too much with them.
Well, the market had spoken in the early 80s. So you had iconic acts, Def Leppard, Michael Jackson, you know, putting out multi-platinum albums. You know, the radio was a lot of ballads, Aerosmith. You see the return of some 70s bands now becoming kind of, you know, more 80s flag bearers for major labels. I mean, Aerosmith is the one I think of. right? I mean, you know,
And I wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to a lot of that direction, because, as I say, when the Penetrators are done, and I actually continued to do my noise music all along. Through that, I was doing it for myself. And I started hosting, I was manager of a movie theater in 1980. So I had a movie theater that I was hosting jams, noise music jams in the movie theater after hours.
Wow.
And so that was happening. I, you know, with my organ and synthesizer and any instrument that I could find. And we'd have as many as 12 people down there just making cacophony.
Yeah. Like the most bizarre drum circle ever. Everybody bring their own electronic noisemaker.
Yeah. And there were some rules: no rock and roll, no jazz,
no Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. Well, definitely that. so anyway, I'm getting back into noise music. I mean, that's the stuff that I'm kind of following, which kind of turns into industrial.
Explain.
At about that time, and there was, you know, some of the KMFDM, the Wax Trax people were coming along at that time.
Right.
So I was looking at that stuff.
Yeah.
At that time.
I just want to get back to the dissolution of the predator of the penetrators, you know. Like, well, I mean, you continue your electronica journey with that.
Sure.
You already were with the theremin at that point?
No, I didn't have a theremin yet at all. I hadn't really thought much about it. I had a 60s record, Lothar and the Hand People, that and Lothar was a thereminist.
Okay.
Or at least he played theremin on the record. So I was aware of it, but I didn't have one, not until well into the 90s. Not until much, much later.
Geez, I want to get into the whole strip club phase.
Sure.
Here.
My life is an open book. I
mean, we're going to have to do this with two shows for sure. I mean,
yeah, we're at an hour, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to spend a lot of time in the strip club. So,
okay. So part two,
should we stop it at 1984? Is that a fair?
that's stop it at 1984. That's a good year.
I mean, Thriller gets released.
That would probably have very little part of the story, but
the world was changing. I definitely want to revisit this conversation for sure. Next show.
Sure.
Because I want to hear about that. And then we never even got into Nicey Nice World, any of that. So, you know what I mean?
We should have known this, actually.
Well, let's do this. Say this one is 1960 to 84?
Let's say that.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank our audience for their kind indulgence.
Well, you know, I think it's important. I know you. They don't. So, you know, when we first hooked up to do these shows years ago, when we did our first couple shows with Cavallino, the comedian.
Right.
You know, I felt like what stood out to me about those early shows is like we're not spending enough time talking about what James has accomplished, really. You know what I mean?
No, not at all.
You know, I'm not in a book in Japan, you know.
Yeah, and I am,
and you are. So we're gonna pick this. We're gonna pick this up again. I don't know if maybe we might take three shows. You know, who knows? But
right, who knows? We do want to cover this. It's an interesting period in history, it's the strangest life I've ever known.
Well, I think anytime you have counterculture becoming the culture, I think you're at a moment in a history of a country, any country, that's a very poignant, interesting moment because things can go in different directions, you know, in that moment. And, you know, I think we did as good as we could with the end of the Vietnam War because we used those anti-war protests for civil rights, for, you know what I mean? It became a thing. And that counterculture of the Vietnam War is the liberal intelligentsia that we have now.
Pretty much true.
In some sense. So I think it's very, very important. So to have your perspective, as a musician, a punk musician, going through all of that, I think it's worth exploring.
We're doing history here, and that's history.
And this is a history show. I mean, it might be, recent history, but we just want to get it on the record. That's the point of all of this. So anyway, James, thank you. Thank you for cracking your
thank you for your
soul open there for us.
Well, thank you for your astute inquiries.
Well, I think Penetrators is one of the best band names ever, so I just I think that goes without saying. I mean, as a punk band name, like, come on.
It worked for us, let's put it that way.
And thank you to the audience. We definitely appreciate your patronage. And this has been All You Fascists.
We don't have anything to do with Patreon.
Not patriotism.
Well, transform back, going on to the kitchen now to make eggs and toast.